Everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Chicago. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Fifth Amendment when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government, for instance, currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American. 15 files on every one of us, and that's according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. If you get a little closer to home, our state and local governments also use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems. Those systems contained 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. All of this information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your bank, your insurance company, or the industries around you obtain all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? And what do they want it for anyway? Well, knowing how this information is gathered and what information is stored and what information that you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. After all, government agencies like the FBI, their agents, and the CIA and their agents have privacy. Why can't you? Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call us here at the law school, the number is 417-273-4967, and ask for our free general law CD package. And let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. And best of all, it's free, and you can call us at 417-273-4967 to order yours. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email when you get there. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about this thing of constitutional rights. We were talking about the Fourth Amendment here last time, but let's take a look at the Fifth Amendment. The two actually work in conjunction with one another. The Fourth Amendment guarantees you the right to be secure, that is, the personal right to be secure in your person, houses, papers, and effects. The Fifth Amendment works like this. You cannot be compelled to testify against yourself. That's a pretty important right. It goes clear back to Magna Carta in 1215. In fact, it goes clear back to the Law of Moses. That principle of law enshrined in our Constitution in the Fifth Amendment goes back to Deuteronomy 19:15, where it says, at the mouth of two witnesses, or at the mouth of three witnesses, shall the matter be established. The establishment of guilt or innocence, or the establishment of the truth of a matter, cannot be compelled out of a victim or out of a witness. It has to be done independently by two or three independent witnesses who can testify in tandem and then be subjected to cross-examination to see whether or not they're telling the truth. And that's why we have a Ninth Commandment that forbids false witnesses, and that the penalty for false witnesses, as stringent as it is, to eliminate this thing of forced confessions and or perjured testimony. Now, these constitutional rights that we call the Bill of Rights in our Constitution are endemic in all of the democracies of the West. You'll find it in Denmark, or the Netherlands, or Germany, Switzerland, France, England, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United States. We, the Anglo-Saxon people, who are the descendants of Moses and the Israelites of the past, do not have these peculiar protections of law in our constitutions and in our written documents or in our histories, such as Magna Carta, for no good reason. You don't find it in Russia or China or Brazil. You won't find it in Japan or Indonesia, but you'll find it in France or Australia or the United States or Canada. And it's not by accident that we have the writ of habeas corpus or the Fourth Amendment protection to protect your private property or to protect your privacy or to protect you from being compelled to testify against yourself. Now, here in America, we have a very famous program. It's called the Miranda Warning. Back in 1964, our Supreme Court actually enshrouded, or enshrined, I guess I should say, that protection, that Fifth Amendment protection, and instructed the police. They said, now listen, if you're going to arrest some guy out here, you got to tell this guy that he's got a right to remain silent. Then if he can't contain himself and he wants to confess, that's fine. But you got to tell him, you know, that he's got a right to remain silent. Now, that seems strange to me because, you know, you should already know that. I mean, if you're the sovereign power, if you're the master, well, then shouldn't you already know? Doesn't the master know? Do you have to go to your servants? Do you have to instruct your servants to instruct you as to what your rights are? That's why I always say, kind of tongue-in-cheek, I'm not really sure that Americans have competency or capacity. They're wards of the state is what the bottom line is. At least that's what we have become in this country. We're now wards of the state. Our servants command us. Our servants direct us. Our servants rule over us. It isn't designed that way, not from the biblical point of view, but that's the way it has degenerated. So I thought, well, let's take a look at the Fifth Amendment. Let me show you some of your rights here that your granddad or your great-granddad or your great-great-great-granddad knew about, and they knew how to conduct themselves when the sheriff came and asked them some questions or wanted to talk to them. They knew what to say and how to say it and who to say it to and when to shut up. But it's something lost in America, and it's lost because of our educational system. You see, we have been taught and trained to confess. And after all, if you don't have anything to hide, why are you afraid? So last time I pointed out that what I'm hiding is my privacy, and if I didn't hide it, I wouldn't have any privacy. And if you said to me, well, what is it that you're hiding, and I told you what I was hiding, then it wouldn't be hidden anymore. Privacy is a right. Privacy is something that belongs to you, and it's only private as long as you know it. My own dad told me one time, he said, son, a secret is a secret as long as you're the only one that knows it. And as soon as you tell one other person, it's no longer a secret. And that's the way privacy works, and you've got it until you give it away, or you are cunningly coerced into waiving it because of your ignorance. Now, you have a right to remain silent, and that'll be a common utterance around the Supreme Court this fall. Justices are going to hear appeals in three cases involving the court's 37-year-old mandate that police officers warn suspects of their rights before beginning interrogations. Now, the eventual rulings will tell police how far they can go to get answers from suspected criminals, and then let the courts know when they must bar confessions or evidence from a trial. Officers who hope to enhance their chances of getting a suspect to divulge key information will sometimes put off reading the Miranda warning to an arrestee after they get a confession or after they get answers that will lead to the weapons or other evidence that the police need to convict this person. Officers will then run through the Miranda warning that have been made famous by TV cop shows. Now, the Supreme Court will decide if it's smart detective work or deceitful trickery to delay that warning. Critics say that people may not realize that information that is divulged before they are read their rights cannot be used at trial, and they then repeat incriminating statements later in formal interviews with the police. Yale Kamisar, a Miranda expert who teaches law at the University of Michigan and the University of San Diego, said police officers are being trained to get around the Miranda warning, and the court should stop it. Now, this is really making a joke out of the whole thing. Even the Supreme Court justices who are not terribly enthusiastic about Miranda have to realize that you either keep Miranda on the books or you don't, he said. Law enforcement is paying attention to the cases that are being decided. And then with that knowledge, they use this trick to get around the Miranda warning. It makes the Miranda warning a joke because if you can get around it and use the information that is obtained in violation of Miranda in court, then of what value is the Miranda warning to begin with? The police want to make the arrest, but they want to make the arrest stick, too, said Bill Johnson. He's the executive director of the National Association of Police Organizations. They don't want to be embarrassed by the prosecutor or the judge. Interrogations are strictly and restricted under the court's 1966 ruling in Miranda v. Arizona, which requires an officer to warn the person that they have arrested, and then they intend to question of their rights to remain silent and to see an attorney before they answer any questions. The court reaffirmed Miranda in 2000, but then gave police a victory this summer with a ruling that officers cannot be sued for violating the standard as long as the confession is not used in a prosecution. The issue of interrogations is also getting some legislative attention. Last month, Illinois became the first state with a law requiring police to tape interrogations and to tape confessions of murder suspects intended to ensure that those in custody are not tortured or coerced in any way. The upcoming Supreme Court cases give people a glimpse of what interrogations can be like. Officers who are armed with an arrest warrant say that they just want to chat with a suspect or a suspected drug dealer before taking him to jail. Officers who arrest a murder suspect at 3 a.m. leave her alone in the interrogation room to give her a little time to think about the situation. A man suspected of calling and hanging up on his ex-girlfriend breaks down in tears when he is confronted by a policewoman, then leads officers to a gun that he has illegally obtained or possessed. In two of the cases from Nebraska and Missouri, questionings were started before the suspects were read their rights. In the third case, from Colorado, the suspect interrupted the Miranda warning and told the officer he already knew his rights. Now, the Supreme Court will decide if the two-step interrogation process is improper when done deliberately by officers to try to get a confession before reading or informing the defendant that he has a right to remain silent. A 1985 court ruling dealt with the same subject, but the double questioning was not deliberate. Both people questioned twice were convicted. The court will also consider if evidence obtained from people that are not read their rights can be used against them. Even with Miranda warnings, an estimated 80% of suspects still talk to the police, Kemisar said. Now, when you read someone their rights, it goes in one ear and out the other, Johnson said. The words have lost their meaning because they've become so common, especially since so many people watch television. Susan Klein, a University of Texas professor, said that there's a good chance, that the court will side with the government in all three cases. The Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination is not a cherished right in this age of terror fighting, she said. It's not something the justices would bend over backward to protect, Klein said. And this is a good time to chip away at Miranda. But Eugene Millhiser, a former Army judge, a judge advocate, and professor at the Ava Maria Law School in Michigan, expects narrow rulings from the court. He said, I don't sense that the court wants to do something revolutionary with Miranda. Well, that may or may not be the case. It was certainly true before 1966 that no one was warned by the police, at least not overtly, that they had a right to remain silent or that they had a right to an attorney. Now, you could rest assured that people who are criminals, people who are in the know, I mean, the mafia, you know, and the professionals, they already knew that. In fact, my experience tells me that the common criminal on the street knows more about shutting his mouth than the average Joe Sixpack, you know, the average guy on the street who's been to public school and who's not involved in crime on a full-time basis. The average person, when confronted by a policeman or any authority figure, will cooperate with that authority figure because they have been taught and trained from the time they're little children that the policeman is his friend. And, you know, when you were a little kid, 6, 7 years old, the policeman is your friend. And there was a famous pope back in the Middle Ages, I've forgotten his name now, Pope Clement or something like that, back about the 11th century. He made an observation. He says, you give me a child until he's seven, and he'll be a Catholic for life. By the time children are 7 or 8 years old, they have already developed, their minds are now developed, those habits that they have been taught from the time they're 2 years old until they're 7 or 8. And if the habit is going to church and flipping through your beads or whatever it happens to be, they'll stick with that for the rest of their lives. Now, if these same children had been taught the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Magna Carta, they would then have that ingrained in them. That is not taught in our public school systems today. You don't find in the public school systems teachers teaching children to remain silent. And if this is a right, if this is something that is enshrined, it's a constitutional right or protection, shouldn't we be taught that in our public schools? And after all, they teach you to vote, don't they? They teach you that the N-word is a bad word and the F-word is a bad word, don't they? You know, if you're going to be a master, if you're going to be the boss, then you have to act the part. Now, here in America, we're constantly told that when you're a voter, that you go out and you're registered to vote and you're going to vote for this guy, that the guy you vote for over here is your public servant. I think if you went to the dictionary and looked up the word servant, you'd find that he's an inferior to the master. The theory behind all of this is that the voter is the master and the public servant over here, the guy that's being voted for or against, is the servant. But that's not the way the police operate. When the police arrest somebody, they take the position of the master and they ask the questions. And certainly, when you're asking questions of somebody, it's certainly a master-servant relationship, and the person who is answering the questions is the servant. Let me ask you this. If you're the master, the voter, and you're voting for the public servant, does your public servant come into your office and ask you questions? I mean, that's pretty important and pretty basic, I would think. Now, I'm an old-timey employer. I'm not a stranger, you know, to the corporate boardroom. I'm not a stranger to being the master in a master-servant relationship with employees. Now, I never had this happen to me, but if it had happened, I can assure you that there would have been sparks everywhere. But never did any of my employees ever come up to me and start asking me questions or making demands upon me that I might answer them. Nobody came to my office making demands upon me that I answer questions. Now, a man might come to me and ask me a question like, Mr. Gordon, did you want me to do X, Y, or Z? That isn't the way the police come up to you and start asking you questions, you know. They assume the position of a master and they start making demands. All right, Bob, we know you did it. What did you do with the gun? Now, the guy that's answering the questions over here is the guy that's in the inferior position. Now, let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that five of your employees captured you and took you prisoner. Yes, in a circumstance like that, I can see where they might be making demands upon you. Here, sign this letter. We're demanding ransom for you. Now, that could happen. But obviously, you're not the master if you've been taken prisoner. So, you know, when a soldier is taken prisoner, he's instructed by the army. He's drilled by his instructors. You give the opponents, you give your captors three things: your name, your rank, and your serial number, and that's it. You don't tell anything else. You don't get in there and start talking to these people. There's a very important reason for that. In interrogation, you don't have to confess or admit to anything. All you have to do is answer questions. And when the questions are put to you in such a way that the answers to those questions reveal the answer that we're looking for, we don't have to ask you, where did you dispose of the murder weapon? You know, we don't have to have a direct confession that the body is buried under the patio. We can ask you a series of questions and we can deduce that you killed your wife, that you killed her with a gun, you buried her under the patio, and that the gun was thrown off the Park Street Bridge. I mean, you know, that's the objective of interrogation. It's not to get you to confess. Now, there is a methodology to get you to confess, and it's called torture. In fact, here in America, we're having quite a debate on this torture thing right now. Can you torture these terrorists down in Guantanamo? Can you kidnap people off the streets and haul them over to some foreign country and have them tortured over there so that we're not doing it, but, you know, one of our allies, one of our surrogates is doing it? And you don't have to be much of a policeman. You don't have to be very knowledgeable in criminology to get a confession out of somebody. You just twist his arm behind his back. You burn him with a cigarette. You apply pain. In this country, we don't call it torture. We call it pain compliance. It goes on all the time. I mean, we got 40,000 police departments in this country, and every one of those police departments uses pain compliance. Now, of course, the Supreme Court took a look at that back in 1964 or 66 here with Miranda, and they said, listen, this thing of torturing people is not acceptable. Now, of course, our President Bush, now he thinks that torture is pretty acceptable, and Dick Cheney and the Republican administration seems to think that it's a necessary evil that we need to employ in order to protect the American people. I don't need it. I don't want it. I can't speak for the other 299,999,999 of you Americans, now that there's about 300 million of us, just speaking for myself. I don't need it, and I don't want it. It runs counter to Anglo-Saxon administration. It runs counter to the law of God. It runs counter to the Mosaic law that we received at Mount Sinai. It runs counter to America and America's principles and the way we've done things in Anglo-Saxon administration and here in America for the last 200 plus years. It is absolutely something that is repugnant and repulsive, and it's something that belongs in Germany or Russia or China. It doesn't belong here. I don't want any part of it. I'm not here to tell you people what you should do, but I'm just telling you from my point of view, I don't want to participate in it. And our Supreme Court has come to that conclusion, our Congress, all of our institutions until the Bush administration. I can't ever remember any administration ever coming forward and saying, well, what's wrong with torture, you know? Hey, you know, we just need to do this. Now, the police, you know, they're not ignorant people, you know, they're very knowledgeable people, and they've got a job to do. And it's a whole lot easier to beat a confession out of somebody. And when I use the word beat, I mean, kids, the police, to my knowledge, never use their fists and punch somebody in the nose and make his nose bleed or hit this guy over the head with a billy club or do something that crass. I mean, the police are very intelligent people. I remember I had a guy named Larry Richards one time, and he uttered these words to six policemen who had hold of me, and he said these words. He said, don't make any marks on him. Don't make any marks on him. And they didn't. When they got through with me, there was not a mark, there was not a bruise. And I hurt real bad for 2 weeks. Now, boys and girls, let me tell you, when the police get through with you, there won't be any marks. And if there are, those are amateurs, and they really don't know how to apply pain compliance. I mean, they're just, you know, ignorant policemen that haven't learned the ropes yet. When they make cuts and bruises and marks on you, that's just carelessness. That's just stupidity. They just don't know what the hell they're doing. And when the police get through with you, you're going to hurt real bad. Now, that's assuming that they apply pain compliance to you. Now, to avoid this pain compliance, you know, if they're dealing with somebody who knows his rights. Now, my experience has been pretty good along this line. When you inform the police about various cases, it could be Miranda or it could be Davis versus Mississippi or some other case, right away they presume that you're an attorney or that you're a lawyer and that you know the law and you know the rules. And once they find that you know the law and the rules, they don't press the issue. That's been my experience. They press the issue against the ignorant, those that don't know. As soon as the policeman senses that you don't know what your rights are, boy, then he just pushes you right to the mat. Now, a fellow by the name of Carl F. Warden, a former policeman, wrote an article, and he had quite a bit to say about this thing of police interrogation. And he said, I have debated writing this article for many months, and I'm a strong supporter of law enforcement, and I have an extensive background in law enforcement. But even now, I have a number of conflicts which cause me great concern with how the information that I'm about to impart to you is going to be used. I don't want to enable the criminals in our society to thwart justice, but I'm just as committed to protecting the innocent from what appears to be an explosion of police abuse. In a case like this, I choose to protect the citizens. Now, I want to interject something right here. You know, I'm in the same boat as this policeman, Carl F. Warden, and that is that as a law school instructor, I don't want to thwart justice, and I don't want the criminals to get away either. We conduct a law school here. This is not a crime school. This is not where you come to school to learn how to become a more successful criminal. And in fact, we're pretty careful about screening people when they come here to school. And if we get the impression, or if we believe that somebody is coming here to learn crime, or to learn law for the purposes of advancing crime, we'll cut them right off. So if you're a policeman and you're listening to this program and you're saying, oh my God, you know, this guy Gordon over here is trying to advance crime and criminality and anarchy. No, calm down now. Just relax. In fact, statistically, about 85% of all of the people that are arrested in this country are in fact guilty. And I don't have any qualms with the police arresting a car thief. I laud the police when they come up with innovative ideas. Like in England, they had a car that was especially, you know, designed to a nice looking car. I don't know if it was a Porsche or something, you know, something that car thieves like to steal. And this car was specially designed and set up here. So when you get into the car and you start the engine, it locks the doors and you're trapped inside. And then the horn goes off and the lights go off. And it goes off like a slot machine in Las Vegas and alerts everybody around that there's something wrong with this car over here. And the guy that's inside the car can't get out. The windows don't work and the doors don't open. And the engine is running. And so then the policeman comes over and he's got a key and he opens the door and he takes the car thief and arrests him for stealing a car. I mean, that's just real neat. And I like the idea of this navigation. They call that North Star or something on an automobile. Some guy goes out and steals a car, and then they trace the car through North Star, and they identify where it is. And this guy's driving down the street, and so the police are alerted, and the cop pulls up behind him and pulls him over and says, you're under arrest for stealing this car. I think that's wonderful. I love it. Can't get enough of it. So I don't think that I'm interested in advancing crime. But 15% of people that are arrested are innocent. And 9%, well, it's more than that. It's 9% of the total. But 9 people out of 15 are convicted and they're innocent. And only 6% who are innocent are exonerated. And it's that 9%, it's just the 9% of that 100 people that the police arrest who are innocent and who are being convicted and sent to jail. Those are the 9% that I'm interested in protecting here at the law school. And that's what these writers are trying to point out here. And that's what the Supreme Court is trying to do with the Miranda warning. It's to protect that 9%. Now, the theory is, or the principle of law used to be in this country, that we would rather turn an innocent man loose than we would to convict, excuse me, we would rather turn a guilty man loose than we would to convict an innocent man. Now in America, under the adversarial system, we put people on trial, and the objective is, if you can't defend yourself, sucker, then you must be guilty. And because of your education, you know, from the time that you were a little kid, taught that this policeman over here is your friend, I'm here to tell you the policeman's not your friend. He's an adversary. Because we no longer use the justice system. You see, the justice system came from Moses and the Ten Commandments. We now have an adversarial system that comes from the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. Adversarial. The prosecutor, the police, the judge, the judicial system is your adversary. That policeman over there is your enemy. He's not your friend. He's there to protect big business. He's there to protect General Motors and Ford and IBM. He's not there to protect Joe Sixpack and Sally Hansbein. That's not his position, then that's not his duty. He's there to protect corporate America, not Joe Sixpack. So Mr. Warden here, he chooses to protect the citizens. Now remember, 85% of these citizens that are being arrested over here, and it may be you. I mean, if you break the law, then you need to be brought to justice. It's the way the game is played. But there's a legitimate interest here on both sides of this issue. And the police have a job. If we're in an adversarial system, the policeman's job is to prove that you're guilty. That's a principle of law that's been going on in Anglo-Saxon administration, you know, for thousands of years. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. It's very timely, very informative. I think it's very interesting. I think it's very interesting. You may think it's dull and boring, but to order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers or the sponsors, the management or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the Law School direct to order that free general law CD package. Remember, the number is 417-273-4967. Well, going on here, Carl Warden says, I'm going to start with law enforcement contacts with regard to traffic stops for suspicion of driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Now, the Fifth Amendment of the Bill of Rights states that we are not to be forced to incriminate ourselves. The actual wording is that you cannot be compelled to be a witness against yourself. So if you're stopped for suspicion of DUI, these are your rights, regardless of the laws of your state. These are your rights, and the Constitution supersedes your state law. First, here's your first move. You are to deny having consumed any alcoholic beverages whatsoever. You are never to admit to having even one or two drinks. Because if you admit to consuming even one drop of alcohol, that opens the door to probable cause. When probable cause is present, that allows the officer to search your vehicle for open containers. Next, you are never to submit to a field sobriety test. You are to refuse to do so. You are to object timely. No, I will not do it. Now, the police cannot make you walk a line. They cannot make you balance or do anything else. You do all of that because you volunteer to. If you're arrested, and you probably will be, you are then to refuse to allow a blood or breath test, regardless of what the state law requires, such as revocation of driving privileges for a period of time. That is simply an attempt to compel you to be a witness against yourself. Now, the Supreme Court decisions in this area are quite specific with regard to your rights, and it follows Lefkowitz versus Turley, cited at 94 Supreme Court 316, and it's also cited at 414 U.S. 70, back in 1973. The Fifth Amendment provides that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. That amendment not only protects the individual against being involuntarily called as a witness against himself in a criminal prosecution, but also privileges him not to answer official questions put to him in any other proceeding, civil or criminal, formal or informal, where the answers might incriminate him in future criminal proceedings. Let me pause for a moment and explain that one. That doesn't mean that if you're a witness sitting on the witness stand and the prosecutor or somebody asks you a question, that you can say, well, I refuse to answer that question on Fifth Amendment grounds. Oftentimes, people will make that mistake and get into trouble. But when a question is aimed at you, the proper form is this. Am I the target of this investigation? Remember Martha Stewart? She opened her mouth and she talked to the police. She talked to the FBI. She was convicted for perjury. She wasn't convicted for the stock manipulation or insider trading. She was convicted for testifying against herself. If she'd have just shut up and said, I'm not talking to you. I may be the subject of a future criminal investigation for insider trading. I'm going to shut up. I want my lawyer. Now, if this is a civil proceeding, you have to answer the questions if you're a witness. And if this is a civil proceeding and the answer that you are about to give could be the beginning point of a criminal investigation, then you need to object right there and refuse to answer. Now, McCarthy versus Arnstein, cited at 266 U.S. 34, squarely held that the privilege is not ordinarily dependent upon the nature of the proceeding in which the testimony is sought or is to be used. It applies alike to civil and criminal proceedings, wherever the answer might tend to subject to criminal responsibility the person who gives that information, supplies that answer. The privilege protects a mere witness as fully as it does one who is a party defendant. You see that in Maness versus Myers, cited at 95 Supreme Court 584. Where the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination is involved, this court has always construed its protection to ensure that an individual is not compelled to produce evidence, which later may be used against him as an accused in a criminal action. Again, if you're not the subject, if you're just a witness and you're here to testify concerning something, you have to give that information. You know, did the red car hit the green car? Or did the green car hit the red car? Did the red car run the red light? But if you're the subject of the investigation, if you're the target, if this answer could incriminate you, you can refuse to answer. The protection does not merely encompass evidence which may lead to criminal conviction, but includes information which would tarnish or furnish a link to the chain of evidence that could lead to prosecution, as well as evidence which an individual reasonably believes could be used against him in a criminal prosecution. That's cited in Hoffman versus United States, cited at 341 U.S. 479. Now remember what I said a little earlier about the chain of investigation. You know, the policeman doesn't say, well, did you murder your wife? He asks you, where is your wife? And you may say, well, I don't know. Well, how long has she been gone? Well, she's been gone for a week. Why didn't you file a missing persons report? Well, I thought she was on vacation. You see, every one of these answers, even by itself, is an innocuous question, an innocuous answer. But you know, as we proceed along, you're incriminating yourself because, well, why didn't you file a missing persons report? You know, normally you do such a thing. Well, I thought she was on vacation. But, you know, a little while ago, you said you didn't know where she was. Well, if you didn't know where she was, then how do you know she's on vacation? If she's on vacation, why don't you know where she is? You see, these answers that you're giving, if you want to give these answers later, you certainly can. I mean, if you want to confess after a week or two or a month or 3 months into the process, you can certainly confess at any time you want to. The police want to get your answers as close to upfront as they can, because the more information they get from you, the greater the opportunity that they have of finding conflicts or conflicting testimony or statements. And those conflicting testimonies and statements are what they're going to use against you. Now, in Castigar versus United States, cited at 406 U.S. 441, we recently reaffirmed the principle that the privilege against self-incrimination can be asserted in any proceeding, civil or criminal, administrative or judicial, investigatory or adjudicatory. In Miranda versus Arizona, cited 86 Supreme Court 1602, we have recently noted that the privilege against self-incrimination, the essential mainstay of our adversary system, is founded on a complex of values. A complex of values, boys and girls, you go clear back to Moses. To maintain a fair state individual, in other words, to maintain a fair state individual balance, to require the government to shoulder the entire load, to respect the inviolability of the human personality, our accusatory system of criminal justice demands that the government seeking to punish an individual produce the evidence against him by its own independent labor, rather than by the cruel, simple expedient of compelling it from his own mouth. In sum, the privilege is fulfilled only when the person is guaranteed the right to remain silent, unless he chooses to speak in the unfettered exercise of his own will. Now, you know, if you feel bad after you have committed this act and you want to confess, that's fine. In fact, God tells us to do just that. He says, you know, confess your sins and then turn from it. No problem there. But this concept that has taken root now in modern America, that it's an expedient to protecting other people here to force confessions out of people is the antithesis of the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. We didn't get that from our God. I don't know what God is espousing this torture, you know, and kidnapping people, and we're doing this to protect the American people. I don't know if it's Allah or Buddha or the United States or Jupiter or Nimrod. You know, there's some gods out here. There's lots of them, and I'm not picking on anyone. You know, you people out there can choose your own gods, but the God of Abraham didn't come up with this idea of torture. And in fact, that's fairly new here in America. Now, there can be no doubt that the Fifth Amendment privilege is available outside of criminal court proceedings and serves to protect persons in all settings in which their freedom of action is curtailed in any significant way from being compelled to incriminate themselves. And please note also, the above as stated by the Supreme Court are rights and privileges as guaranteed by the Constitution, and anyone, including judges, who knowingly violates those rights may be civilly and criminally liable under several federal statutes. So take a look at United States Code Title 18, Section 241, Conspiracy Against Rights, and Section 242, Deprivation of Rights Under Color of Law, Title 42, Section 1983, Section 1986, Civil Rights, and most attempts to pursue action under these laws fail. But very skilled litigators with good factual circumstances can sometimes get some satisfaction. Now, however, if more individuals were to understand the above rights and exercise them at the appropriate times, more successful litigation could be the outcome. All right, now, have you got that? You cannot be forced to provide evidence against yourself. Therefore, you must not allow any tests whatsoever, be it field sobriety tests or walking the line or a blood or breath test, period. None. Zero. Zilch. And you will be threatened. You will be intimidated. You will be fearful. You will be afraid. But if you will follow these instructions, they have no case against you, and they're also barred from taking away your driving privileges under the same Supreme Court rulings. It's a threat that they use. Now, to more serious matters. If you're contacted as a possible suspect, nor even a witness in any other law enforcement investigation, you are to say absolutely nothing. This is where Martha Stewart broke this rule. She told the police. She'd been taught all of her life, the police are her friends, and I'm to cooperate with the police. It was so ingrained in her subconscious mind that she couldn't control herself. She had to talk to the police, and she did. And she was convicted by the very police that she talked to. You're to say nothing. Even when your attorney is present, you don't say anything. Even if your attorney advises you to talk to the police, don't do it. Remember that the attorney is licensed by the state, and it's the state that's bringing the action against you. So if you're acting as your own attorney, take your own advice and shut up. If you're taking the advice of the state's attorney who tells you to talk, you should shut up. Don't take his advice. You are to say nothing, regardless of evidence of your guilt, as presented by the law enforcement officers. You're not to try to explain away any of the circumstances of the evidence. They may present an empty beer bottle and say, "We got this out from underneath your seat." They may present this evidence to you. Shut up. You are to say absolutely nothing. You don't admit to it, and you don't deny it. And if you could learn to just say nothing, stand mute. Don't open your mouth. Don't say, yes or no, or I don't know, or gee, I don't know how it got there. Could you just shut your mouth? I know it's a wild concept. I got to tell you a little story here. I was in police custody one time, and they're asking me questions, and I never said a word. From the time the policeman stopped me out on the highway, "You're under arrest," put on the cuffs, took me to jail. The policeman said he hasn't said a word from the time I arrested him. And then they started writing me notes. "Are you deaf? Are you a deaf mute? Are you mute? Can you speak?" I had done my job very well. When the policeman writes you a note and says, "Are you deaf? Are you a mute?" you don't shake your head yes or no, because at that point they'll have to ask themselves the question, "Gee, can this guy even read?" The less they know, the better off you are. You're to say absolutely nothing, no matter how tempted you may be to try to talk or to talk your way out of this situation so you can go home. You are to give them absolutely nothing to verify. If they ask you if the sky is blue on a clear day, you don't answer yes or no, and you certainly don't tell them what color it is. Because if you told them the sky was blue, it would prove that you're not colorblind. Now, why do you want to let the police know that you are or are not colorblind? You know, if you were colorblind, that could be a valuable defense to you at a later time. So why give the police that piece of information? There isn't any piece of information that you give to the police that can help you. The information that you do give to the police can only help the police, and it can only harm you. Now, why would you want to talk to an enemy, an adversary? And remember, this is not a justice system, boys and girls. Here in America, we used to have the justice system predicated upon the Ten Commandments. We now have the adversarial system that's predicated upon the Roman civil law, and it comes right out of the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. Now, most Americans are communists, and if you want to practice communism, just get right in there and talk to the police like Martha Stewart. Just spill your guts. Be the loquacious witness. Tell them everything they want to know. Get right after it. But if you want to practice the Ten Commandments, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, and the First Amendment, shut your mouth. You are to give them nothing whatsoever. Whatever evidence or witness information they have, you are to say nothing. Even denying any of their allegations can be used against you in a presentation in the prosecution, if it is determined later that you obviously lied. So if they said, "Have you been drinking?" and you say, "No, I have not," and later they can prove that you were drinking, it proves that you lied to them. And that's what Martha Stewart did. She lied to the police. You are to stand mute. Don't speak. Don't talk. The reason for this is very simple. The evidence the law enforcement officers have is all they must be required to work with. Don't give them anything more. The only time you should consider the option of telling your side of the story is when you speak to your attorney in privacy or in a court of law if you're being prosecuted and you take the witness stand. Because you have stood mute, giving law enforcement nothing in addition to the extrinsic evidence and witness information at hand, the burden of proof available to the district attorney is severely limited and will most often result in a dismissal of charges unless their evidence and witness input is overwhelming and compelling enough for a grand jury to return a bill of indictment. And even if you're bound over for trial, the jury will be limited to consider only that evidence and witness input, nothing more. Now, when you're given your Miranda rights, wherein you're informed that anything you say can and will be used against you, take it to heart. If you say absolutely nothing, nothing can and nothing will be used against you in a court of law, because all of the evidence that's ever going to be presented against you is going to be furnished by you, all of it. Now, there are literally thousands of people behind bars today who tried to talk their way out of law enforcement contact. Don't fall for that ploy. Law enforcement officers are trained to bluff you into making denials or statements. The denials can be just as valuable as an admittance. They will appear friendly and reasonable. This is called the Mutt and Jeff routine. They will appear willing to help resolve the matter if you will just cooperate with them. They will tempt you into talking about it and appear to be sympathetic. But it's a ploy, so don't fall for it. Say nothing, give them nothing, admit to nothing, and don't deny anything either. Give them nothing. Stick your tongue between your teeth, and then bite down real hard. You are to be a marble statue. You do not exist. You have no past. You have no address. You have no name. You have no social security number, and you are to give them nothing whatsoever to work with. Now, boys and girls, I wished I would have thought of that. But that story, that article, comes from Carl F. Warden, a policeman who has been in law enforcement for many years. And his interest in this, he said, I choose to protect the citizens against the police because the police have run amok. Now, that doesn't mean that all policemen have run amok. There are some policemen out there that know their role in life, know their position. And I've run across many of them and had contact with them, and I'm not complaining about those. But kidnapping people off the streets of Italy and taking them to Amman, Jordan to be tortured over there is reprehensible and it's repulsive. And that kind of behavior goes on here in the United States also against United States citizens here in this country. And it's called pain compliance. See if you can remember that. Pain compliance. And it's usually used against ignorant people. Ignorant people. It's time that we woke up, boys and girls, and it's time that we shed our ignorance and learned and had some knowledge. I mean, if we're going to become masters, if you want to be the master of the situation or the circumstance, then you have to act the part. So there's the story on the Fifth Amendment, which goes along with the last report I gave you on the Fourth Amendment, and tomorrow night we'll take a look at something new. So let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page of our website at georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by pre-arrangement. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.